Welcome, everybody. Thank you for us. Just a minute or two to join us. We'll start right at 11. Welcome, welcome. Thanks for joining us. All right, it's 11. So welcome everybody to Meet the Grantmakers online. My name's Angela Richardson, and I am a senior trainer at the Grantsmanship Center. I am joined with a very esteemed panel that I'm excited to introduce to you. And I wanna just let you know that this particular webinar is sponsored by the Grantsmanship Center, Grant Station, and Foundant. So I wanna thank our sponsors for providing this opportunity to meet with the panel I wanna thank you all for the questions that you sent in. And with no further ado, I'm going to jump in and introduce you to who we've got here on the panel. All right, so the first person I want to introduce is Wendy Guerin. She is I'm going to introduce their name so you can see, and then I'm going to formally do their bios and then they'll introduce yourself. So Wendy Guerin is with me, and Maurice Green is here, and Kevin Weiberg as well. So Wendy, who is now featured on our screen, Wendy is the president and CEO of the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation here in Los Angeles, which is where I am as well. She's been there since 2008. She's got over 20 years, and I'm sure even more than that, of work with foundations and implementing a philosophy of what they call responsive philanthropy. And so I'm hoping she'll talk a little bit more about what that means, because I think that's so important. She's also on the advisory board of the Center for Philanthropy and Public Policy at USC. And as someone who lives in Los Angeles, I know that there is a very long list of things that she's done to really support and move forward the community here in Los Angeles, of which we're very grateful. Next on the panel is Maurice Green. He is the executive director for the Z. Smith Reynolds Foundation in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. He's been there since 2016. They've invested over $608 million into the North Carolina communities. Mo is what people call him. He's launched what Mo Wants to Know, which is an initiative that is a listening and learning tour that brings the entire foundation into the communities to really hear what folks have to say. So I'm looking forward to hearing a little bit more about that as well. Thank you for being here with us. And last but not least is Kevin Weiberg. Kevin's experience on the grant maker side, as well as on the grant seeker side. Kevin is a colleague of mine. He used to serve as a senior trainer here at the Grantsmanship Center. I haven't seen him in a while, so it's such a delight to see him. His current position is, he is the philanthropic advisor for community engagement for the Vermont Community Foundation in Middlebury, Vermont. Kevin is a community activist. He is an artist. He is someone who is down for the community and supports and so many different ways. So I'm thrilled to have you, Kevin. It's so good to see you again. And another person who you cannot see currently is Linda Bedeker, who is she is in the chat. She's our chat facilitator. So as you put questions in there and comments, she'll be answering some of them in the chat. So I wanted to just let you know that Linda is also here and available on the back end of things to really help with today's panel. So let's see. I want to let you know that each of these esteemed panelists, their foundations, their profiles are available for you to read. They're going to share a little bit about foundations. But then if you want to read more about who they are and the type of giving that they do, the panels will be available. And I think there'll be a link there in the chat. So let's see, a little bit of housekeeping about how this will go. So we'll have about 35, 40 minutes. you all sent in some incredible questions. So we'll start with going through some of those questions. Each of the grant makers will have an opportunity to answer them. Like I said, Linda will be answering some of them as well. And then at the very end, if we have time for some live questions, we'll do that as well. All right, let us transition now into each of the grant makers. What I'd love for you all to do is to introduce your foundations. Each of you represents a very different kind of foundation, which is really exciting for this panel. I think it might have been Kevin who first told me, you know, when you know one grant maker, you know exactly one grant maker, because they're all so very different. And so we, on this panel today, we have three very different grant makers doing different kinds of work, and also that being located in a different geographic region of our country. So it'll be interesting to see how things are similar and how they're different. So with that, I'd love to go ahead and start with Wendy.
Glad to be here.
Yes.
So should I begin with a description of the Parsons Foundation, Angela?
Yes, please. Yes, please.
Okay, it's a thumbnail. We represent an independent foundation because there were no heirs. Ralph Parsons was an engineer who built a worldwide civil engineering firm. And at his death, we received what was inelegantly called the residue of his personal estate. Today, the foundation has assets of $400 million, and we've made over $500 million in grant making. It's like the perpetual motion machine if you get it right. Our grant making started in 1978. And today we are, this is our mission. We improve the well-being of the residents of Los Angeles County through responsive grant making in human services, civic and cultural organizations, education and health. Very broad. We encourage people to go to our website. We talk about the fact that we're a responsive grant maker, and that we believe that nonprofits know what's best for the people and communities they serve. So we invest in organizations whose work really strengthens the broad fabric of Los Angeles. The majority of our grants are for general operating support. They really are unrestricted. But we also provide funds for programs, capital needs. We do prioritize organizations that are service delivery in nature. We do have an LOI process and an online process. We have found that grantees have welcomed that. You know, there was a lot of anxiety moving toward that, but it turns out it can be very user-friendly, and it made us able to pivot into this virtual reality that we're living much more seamlessly because we had invested so much in our online capacity. I think that's it.
Great. Thank you so much, Wendy. Mo?
Good afternoon to everyone. Certainly my pleasure to be here this afternoon. So the Z. Smith Reynolds Foundation is a private family foundation that is over 80 years old. Z. Smith Reynolds was the son of R.J. Reynolds of Reynolds Tobacco, if you will. The mission is to improve the lives of all North Carolinians. And so you hear right there that we are focused solely on one state, North Carolina. But in our organizing documents, it says, and I'll paraphrase, that we're to accomplish charitable works for the state of North Carolina. And so that certainly allows the foundation to be broad in what it can do. And it has been in the 80 plus years. But I always like to bring up that this foundation is one that is willing to lean in and support people in that are marginalized by society, or to address issues that maybe other foundations aren't willing to address. The very first grant that was made by the foundation was to try to eradicate venereal diseases. That was a grant to the North Carolina Department of Health in the 1930s. And so you can see right off the bat, this foundation is one that's willing to try to tackle issues that perhaps others are not. Certainly, the focuses have changed over time. Currently, we have three strategies. We have a state-level systemic change strategy that has four priority areas around public education, democracy, the environment, and issues around social and economic justice. We have a community-based strategy, and then we have what we call an exploratory visionary idea strategy, which is intended to really suggest that we ought to lean into innovative ideas or address issues that perhaps need addressing in our state. We also have three commitments. Those are around continued learning, certainly augmenting our participation in our hometown of Winston-Salem. And then finally, that we'll use a racial equity lens in all that we do.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much. Appreciate that. And Kevin?
Good afternoon, everyone, or good morning. I'm not quite sure. I'm on the Eastern Standard Time, but
we're in morning here in Los Angeles. Yeah.
Okay, well, good morning, everyone. I hope if you haven't had a chance to visit Vermont, please do. We're a mighty little state, and I would say that's how we define our community foundation. The Vermont Community Foundation is a public charity. It was founded in 1986, and our mission today is that we believe that we're better together, inspiring and bringing people and resources to make Vermont a better place. We have 852 different funds, and over $370 million in assets. And to give you a context, the entire population of Vermont is about 630,000. It might be higher now because of COVID, but we're a really pretty small state. But what that allows us to do as a foundation is that we are can be very nimble. We can pivot quickly. So to date, in last year, we did $44 million of grants and resources to Vermont communities. We have 20 discretionary grant programs that require an application. But I would say that the vast majority of the funds that go through the Community Foundation are direct from our donor advised funds to the charities that they hold dear. We also do mission investing. And last in 2019, we did over 3,000 grants, totaling over almost $45 million. And thank goodness I did not have to read all 3,000 of those grants. That would be insane. So the majority of the funding here comes out directly from our fund holders and to different nonprofits around the state. I will say that in Vermont, relationships are key. And this, I hope, is the first lesson you can take from our talk today, is that relationships matter. So when you're approaching a foundation such as a community foundation or even a private foundation, your best strategy is to start it as a conversation with no preconceived expectations. Where we've been since I joined the foundation in 2017, and we immediately started focusing on what's called the opportunity gap. And that's really about how do we help Vermonters who are working but just can't get ahead. And so we focused our funding on early care and learning, college and career training, support for youth and families, and community and economic vitality. As much as us did in March, I went from working in my office to 2 days working from home. And that is almost a year later. But we've been busy. And we did a hard pivot to focus on COVID-19. Our amazing philanthropic team did a full court press and raised over $8 million, eight additional million dollars that normally would go through the Community Foundation. And some other things that we did COVID hit is we removed all reporting requirements from our existing grantees. And we turned our focus on to response and recovery. And we also allowed our grantees to just pivot from program support to general operating support. And I think that's another thing about a community foundation like the Vermont Community Foundation is that we're able to be pretty nimble and responsive as things change. So moving forward, we realized that we were not going to be a straight line from response to recovery in COVID. So we continue to make grants to organizations responding to basic human needs. And we've also developed five different initiatives that we're focused on in the recovery part of COVID, which is rural connectivity, welcoming equitable and anti-racist communities, food systems resilience, learners in transition, and rural recovery and entrepreneurship. And we've been super busy. So I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, thank you so much. So good to hear what you guys have been up to. It's really robust. All right, so now we'll shift to some of the questions that the participants sent in. Some of you have already touched on them in your introduction, so feel free to mention new things or skip if you feel like you've mentioned it already. A couple of quick things for the participants. Yes, we are recording, as you can probably see, and the recording will be available after the webinar is over. And also, you can probably already tell also that we are, there haven't been any advanced captioning requests, but we do have Zoom auto captioning. So you can, and if you would like to switch it off, the directions are in the Q&A, I believe. So there's a couple of little logistical things that I wanted to mention. So we'll turn toward the questions, and I want to start with Wendy. One of the participants said that the pandemic is proving to stay around longer than many of us expected. Kevin mentioned, like, here we are a year later. We're certainly going on that here in Los Angeles as well. Wendy, what would you, from your vantage point as a funder, what impact has the pandemic had on your foundation, its priorities, its expectations for grantees, and your approaches for giving?
Well, you know, let me start with the immediate emergency response, because I think I can speak for the field in some ways. Many of us that are members of the Council on Foundation moved rapidly to release restrictions on grants, and grants that had been formerly restricted were made general operating or fully unrestricted. We also waived reporting requirements. The notion was really to lift the burden from grantees in a time of great stress. And it was very consistent, really, with our grant making anyway. So for us, it wasn't a big challenge to do that. You know, in terms of our priorities, I think initially there was a rush to do relief work. The foundation did make a whole tranche of grants for childcare for first provide, you know, for frontline providers, for food banks, et cetera. But one of the most important things that we did was our board authorized what we would call an overspend. You know, the foundation wants to be around forever. Ralph Parsons will live forever, you know, and some donors, that's important to them. Now, we can't ask Ralph because he's gone. But we've had a preference for the idea of foreverness. And we're pushing at that because we authorized, maybe this is inside baseball, but a 7% payout. Well, it's multi-millions of dollars more than we would have normally spent because we're in a once in a lifetime, we believe it's a once in a lifetime crisis. There's also going to be some silver linings we can talk about. I guess the last thing I'll share is we stepped up to create a pooled fund for recovery in the arts in LA County, and we just announced it last week. We've raised $40 million for small to mid-sized arts organizations. It's not relief, it's for recovery. And the hope is that we'll be able to provide a minimum of 2 years significant general operating support, followed by a third year. And we think we can raise $60 million. We've got 40 already. Now, so that's extraordinary. That's not normal work for us, but it was the moment calling on us.
I would underscore that that's extraordinary. I used to work in the arts, and that's incredible. So I love that you brought up that there's silver linings in this. Oftentimes when we think about what has been our response to COVID, it is really relief and all of those things, but there's been some silver linings, and I appreciate you bringing that to the forefront. Maurice, we'll move on to you.
Yes, and please feel comfortable calling me Mo. I would say a few things. First of all, I think about it as both short term and long term. Short term, our priorities really are going to stay essentially the same. The three main strategies that I mentioned earlier will remain the strategies for the foundation. Short term, as I was listening to Wendy, many of the things that the Parsons Foundation did for its grantees, we did as well. To really try to make it as easy as possible for our grantees to work through the crisis situation. And then given that we are essentially a general purpose foundation, our trustees really needed to grapple with, well, where are we going to put dollars in the short term? And they ultimately decided to focus in a few areas. One, certainly some direct services, some emergency grants as well, but then decided to focus on things like workers' rights and workers' safety, focus on criminal justice issues, and that also led into some of the escalating racial tensions that occurred over the summer and beyond. Focus on safe and fair elections. I really felt like it was important during COVID to be sure that folks were able to vote in a safe and fair manner. We also focused on providing some grants into public education as well. And then finally, there were some particular communities that we wanted to be sure were paid attention to, particularly the indigenous tribes in our state. And even the Latinx community. So those were just some things that we decided to focus on within our grant making during COVID.
Thank you so much, Mel. And Kevin.
Yeah, I think the only thing I would add to what I had said earlier is that we immediately focused on basic human needs. In order to get money out as quickly as possible, we also relied on networks and key trusted partners. So the Vermont Food Bank, for example, we made a large grant to the Vermont Food Bank so that they could send money out to almost, I would say, 175 local food pantries around the state. We did also focused on housing and homelessness, the domestic violence network, and really trying to make sure that our initial response to COVID was going to support those Vermonters at greatest risk and with the greatest need.
Thank you. Some of you have mentioned this a little bit in your comments, but I want to just ask this question directly because it seems like 2020 was a bit of relief and recovery. It feels like as we start moving to 2021 and beyond, and maybe even post-pandemic, dare we even say, there is this recovery and then the strategies for moving forward. And I'm imagining that you've learned many things during this time that, you know, a number of you have mentioned things like dropping reporting requirements and will that stay or will that not stay, things like that. So my question, and Mo, we'll start with you this time. One of the question was, what shifts in grant making do you anticipate for 2021 and post-pandemic?
Yes, I would talk about the actual operations, and then I'll talk about the strategies as well. And so starting with the strategies, as I mentioned earlier, I think long term, our priorities are going to essentially remain the same, that we're going to still have our three main strategies and really won't veer from there. What I do think will happen is those strategies will certainly evolve as we listen to our partners, our grantee partners, and our broader community, and explore opportunities with them post-COVID. You know, we made a grant, for example, to an organization that focuses on education. We basically said, use this grant to begin to reimagine what education can be like in North Carolina. And so as they're doing their work and coming up with potential recommendations, that may evolve then what we do and support with regards to education. On the operations side, I think we're going to lean into a number of different things as we go forward. It's hard to say for certain what will stay and what will go, but you know, it really calls into question, do we need the more extensive reporting that we have before? Can we do something that's short and sweet? And can we use other types of vehicles we're going to be leaning into, for example, with one of our strategies to have verbal reporting, video reporting as opposed to in writing. One thing that we did is we streamlined our applications for our state level systemic change, which is our major grant making. And so the question will be, how can we, you know, I'm sure there's one more question we need to ask, but now we're going to be asking ourselves, do we need to ask that question in our application? So there'll be things like that that I think will change and evolve as a direct result of going through our COVID experience.
Yeah, I can really appreciate some of those words you touched on where it's like it's evolving. Grant seekers, our work is evolving, your work is evolving, we're all, something's evolving. And I love that what you posed to that organization about reimagining education. I think we're all in that place of reimagining to some degree the work that we do. So thank you for that. Kevin, how about you?
Well, I think, you know, we're going to continue understanding that recovery is a long process. We're going to continue focusing some of our grant making in that regards. The other thing I would say is what this experience pointed out to Vermont in general and to the Community Foundation were all the weaknesses in our systems and our ability to respond. So we're really looking at how can philanthropy help fix those systemic issues. And I think one of the things we'll be looking at is resiliency and lessons learned, because if we can't take the lessons learned from COVID, and we need to prepare ourselves for the next crisis that's coming along. So we'll continue to do our discretionary grant making. Our focus will probably continue to be on things like rural connectivity, welcoming and equitable anti-racist communities, food systems resilience. Food is a big part of Vermont's life, culture, and economy, as well as learners in transition. And that also includes recognizing that the path to success for everyone is not going to be a four-year college degree. So I think moving forward, we're going to be taking all the lessons learned and really relying more on some of our community partners like the Food Bank and the Department of Health and the Anti-Domestic Violence Network to help us understand where we can best be most impactful in our grant making in the future. So I'd say that was one of the positives of all the research that we did, and we made hundreds and hundreds of calls, is that we have now even a better idea of who our strategic partners are and can be in the future.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I appreciate that. I think partnership, I think across the board, people are looking at, you know, we've had the time to stop. We always hear partnership. But I think during this time, a lot of organizations are actually forging those strategic partnerships, just as you mentioned. Appreciate that. We'll turn towards you and Wendy and the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation.
I think I'll embroider, if you will, Kevin's remarks about collaboration. Over the past decade in Los Angeles, I think we've been working really hard to establish a collaborative culture among philanthropy and doing it in genuine relationship with grantees. Less top-down, more engaged. And another piece is being willing not just to co-fund, but co-design work and to work in hand in glove with government. You know, I'll just share, for example, Parsons Foundation is very engaged in around systems change work in foster care, child welfare. You know, and if you're not engaging with the County of Los Angeles, you're kind of fiddling at the edges of the system and you're not going to have much impact. So we've gotten very much better at drawing all of the parties together to really work in a collective impact framework that levels the playing field and engages more people to have impact. And another example was the Arts Fund that I mentioned. Another is we collaboratively brought in Bridgespan, which is a sort of a very impactful high-end consulting firm. And they're going to be in Los Angeles for the next 5 years working with small to mid-sized organizations with a particular sort of overrepresentation of BIPOC organizations, organizations that are led by and serving communities of color, so that we can strengthen those organizations who have been sort of not at the table sufficiently and not funded enough. The Arts Fund is doing something similar. So I think all of those things are silver linings, you know, that we should be doing this anyway. And I think that this moment has encouraged us to be more actively engaged with others. And it is that African proverb, you know, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. You know, and we are trying to go far. And, you know, and I think that means working in partnership with our grantees. You know, what do they need? What do they want from us? We brought the Bridgespan capacity building project to LA because in our CEP survey, our grantees said to us, it's nice you've invested in the executive directors, et cetera, but we need help building out our bench strength. What can you do for us to help strengthen our bench strength as organizations? So we were able to address that. So much of this is working in really deep collaboration with others. I guess the last thing I'll just flag, for a decade, we've been encouraging nonprofits locally to consider strategic restructuring, deep collaborations, and mergers. And there are now 8 of these efforts around the country. And this isn't about culling the herd. This is about having more impact. And I think that's another theme that isn't going to go away.
Yes, agreed. 100% agreed. The last kind of question I want to bring forward, and I've seen some of the chats jumping with this question or some version of this question, is really about some of the civil unrest that took place in 2020. And so the question that a participant submitted was, how has the civil unrest of 2020 reshaped the way philanthropists are viewing/approaching their giving strategies with more focus on racial equity? And I also saw this question in the chat pop up, which was, and are there any ways that you're asking that of your grantees also? So speak to any of those topics. And Kevin, this time we're going to start with you.
From the most least diverse state in the nation. Thank you, Angela. As I said, welcoming equitable and anti-racist communities, that was something that really sort of arose through our COVID work. And now we're really looking at, you know, what can we do? How can we support those communities to be thriving and successful? And doing it in a way that we're not telling them what to do. You know, in Vermont, it's not unusual to be having a conversation around race and everyone around the table is white. You know, that's just the nature of it, the nature of Vermont. However, we're really kind of focusing on leadership. And I'm glad, Wendy brought up leadership. We believe that the power of philanthropy when it comes to anti-racism work is that we can help build leaders. We can help support leaders in the BIPOC community. And the younger we start, the better. So I would say this is going to be a theme throughout all of our, through our funding through this year. We're even making it a priority in some of our discretionary grant programs that if you're going to design a strategy to have a wholesome community conversation about race and diversity and opportunity, we want to help support that. So that's one of the things that we're looking at as well.
Great. Thank you so much, Kevin. And Wendy?
I agree that, it's a moment of racial reckoning, and I'll just say transparently, until I watched George Floyd murdered in front of me, I don't think I would have said we were a racist country. Mm. And so I think, just speaking very personally, I think we're at a no turning back moment. We're not going to be able to paper over. And also, we're going to be unable to say, oh, that's not who we are. Actually, it turns out it is who we are. And we better step up to it. And so it does mean figuring out ways to be highly intentional. I think part of the challenge here is it isn't about talk, it's about action. What actions do we take that are anti-racist, right? So for example, in that BridgeSpan project, it's just like when you're recruiting a staff member, you have to work extra hard to get a diverse recruit to join you. Because there aren't that many really, because we're not gonna go, oh yeah, you can be a lesser person and not as competent and we'll take you because you're diverse. No, we want it all. We want, emotional intelligence, intellectual rigor, the ability to work with others. Those are hard hires to get, right? You've gotta work extra hard and you've gotta create an environment that those people are, really wanna be with you. So I think we have to change internally to make it comfortable for people to join us. I think we have to work extra hard and do the extra work. And I think when we're doing grant making, I think it's, while it's not normal, to lean into, we're gonna work harder to try to support the organizations that are minority led and minority serving and bring them up. So I think that's a theme that is gonna be relentless.
Yeah, I don't think it's going anywhere soon. I know for sure. And Mo, how about you? You mentioned a little bit of it in your opening remarks, what's happening down there in North Carolina, down there for
me. Yes. So I would say for Z. Smith Reynolds, this isn't as big a pivot. We have a long history of focusing on racial equity in the foundation and in our grant making. So it's not really as big a pivot for us. The thing that I will say is then when we decided to do a new framework, we went through our, and you mentioned it earlier, the Mo Wants to Know Listening and Learning Tour. So we did that. And one of the things that was reaffirmed for us was that we really needed to focus on racial equity. And so that Listening and Learning Tour was taking place in 2016 and into 2017. We launched our new framework in 2018. And so at that time is when we said we're going to have a commitment that all that we do, we're going to include a racial equity lens in all that we do. And so that has continued into 2019, 2020, and certainly with the escalating racial tensions. We were primed for this moment. Now, having said that, I can tell you quite honestly that there is still a ton of work for us to do internally and then how we work with organizations in our communities across the state externally as well. So we have a racial equity set of consultants that's working with us internally so that we can really examine our culture and how we can continue to evolve and improve our work. And then certainly there are things that we're doing to try to be much more intentional about grant making and other opportunities externally as well. Constantly sort of questioning what our percentage of grant making is to people of color, BIPOC organizations, or the not only percentage of number of grants, but then dollars given to different organizations. Are we, do we have a deficit model in the way that we're doing our grant making? And so do we need to change that and really appreciate that many of these organizations have many assets and we just need to recognize and support them with the assets that they have. So there's constantly things that we're doing, assumptions that we're really challenging, but this isn't for us. This wasn't sort of this big moment for us where we needed to make a substantial pivot for within our foundation.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I can really appreciate, all of you touched on this in some way, that for grant makers, it's both an internal reflection of the for the organization, as well as looking at how to make a change in our communities at large, and that it really is something that's here to stay, you know, for a while, and that's, and I'm also heartened by the fact that you guys are all in different parts of the country, you're saying similar things in your own context. Wendy, did I see?
I just hope that I didn't paint a picture that this was all new. For us, because our grant making has been solidly focused on service delivery to disadvantaged populations. So while it was not specifically a racial lens, it certainly was, you know, our grant making is about the well-being of Angelenos. So it's not a big pivot either. It's making something explicit.
Yes. Yes. Thank you. Thank you for adding that. So I want to pivot in our last little bit of time that we have here. We've been talking about some of the higher, the broader themes of the pandemic and racial equity and inclusivity, et cetera. And now I want to, there's a number of questions about the sort of the nuts and bolts of submitting proposals and things like that, topics that come up. And I know I gave you all a really long list, so you have them all. So I'm going to move around that list just a little bit. And I want to talk a little bit about sustainability. I want to go to the financial one first. So here's one of the questions was, what are some of the key factors that grant makers look for when reviewing financial documents? So especially in this time, what is a financially healthy organization right now in terms of grant proposals that they're submitting? And Wendy, go ahead. Why don't you start that one off?
Yeah, I'll say a few things. First of all, in California, organizations with budgets of $2 million or more are required to have an audit. That's a really good thing. Parsons has always set our limit at $1 million on audit. We wanna see audits when your organization's activities exceed that. Because I like to start actually with a review of the audit, because the audit has notes and the notes are sort of where the dead bodies are. If there are issues or problems like related party transactions or all kinds of things, we really start there. So once you've understood the audit and what it might tell you, presuming you've got one, then the next is looking at really the balance sheet and statement of activities. And, you know, we are going to need to be more flexible currently on organizations that have experienced deficits. Certainly, there are lots of foundations who have had the policy of, oh, things like, you know, we won't fund you if you've had an operating deficit, or do all of your board members give? I think a lot of those hard and fast rules during this period are going to need to be relaxed because the reality is, you know, everyone is damaged going through this crisis. What is also really important is for the executive at the nonprofit to really understand their financials. I can't tell you how many times in my career I've visited a nonprofit and I've got a, you know, they obviously don't understand their own checking account, you know, or what it means, you know, and that the you know, the carrots mean, you know, that you spent more money than you took in. The lack of financial sophistication is a big problem for the sector. So just, you know, I would just say really understanding your own financials, being able to explain them and defend what happened and why and what steps you're taking to address it And then this is sort of a similar question, and the three of us might be different on this, but it is not very many organizations with budgets of under $100,000 that we're going to fund, because they tend to be more like hobbies. Now, that might not be true in a rural community, but I, you know, it's also, I think, a very tough moment to be starting up brand new things. And people ought to be trying to hook up with other organizations initially till they build out what they've got, I think, rather than starting up the brand new day. I just think, you know, on the same, at the same time, you don't want to tell the person with the killer idea, you know, because there will be breakouts. But on the whole, I don't think this is a great time to start the brand new.
Thank you. Thanks, Wendy. How about you, Mo?
I would say there are first going to be some legal issues that we want to be sure that we address. You know, so, and the financial statements can be a good place to explore some of those. So things like lobbying expenses and being sure that the activities are North Carolina-based activities for us. Yeah, there are other things that I could lift up. That gives you, you know, sort of an example of some things that we're looking at from a legal context. Then for us, you know, certainly want to see, you know, for established organizations, a set of financials that suggest that over the last couple of years, you've been able to manage, you know, with a balanced budget, if you will. And if not, let's explore why that is and how you're planning to address any sort of shortfalls. but as I said earlier, you know, Z. Smith Reynolds turns out to be one of those foundations that is willing to take chances with newer organizations that might not have a lot of resources, because we believe they're important to the overall ecosystem. Or to, you know, the state level systemic change, or they're important to a particular community. And so, you know, there we want to just use the financials to have a conversation and explore, you know, the leaders' understanding of what they have in their financials, how they're going to try to move the organization forward. What support can we give them along the way? Those sorts of questions that we might be posing. But we're not going to be automatically sort of turned off because the financials suggest that there may be some questions or some concerns about the stability of an organization. We want to use it as a chance to have a conversation.
Sorry, I was muted. And Kevin, anything to add?
I'll just add that, you know, we do look at financials even from some of our smaller grantees, but we look at them within context. So we'll have a different expectation of a $6 million organization than we will have of an organization with a budget of under $100,000. That's just fair. We do give folks opportunities to talk about budget deficits, and I think the three of us are going to be seeing a lot of those conversations in the next year or so because of the pandemic. But other things that we look for is sort of multiple sources of funding. We don't want to be your only source of funding. We actually would prefer to be last money in when that's possible, but we also see that we have a role of inspiring other organizations by being sometimes first money in and taking a risk. So we do look at budgets, balance sheets, profit loss stuff. And then the one thing we will look at, particularly when it comes to larger organizations, is what's your unrestricted funding look like? Because we will have multi-million dollar organizations apply for us for a $5,000 grant to help discuss a merger. But when we look at their financials, they have plenty of resources that they could be funding that on their own. So we will make some sort of decisions around that. But we lower our expectations for those small nonprofits, of which there are hundreds of them in the state of Vermont.
Amazing. Thank you. And I'm going to pivot to a question that I see here in the chat, which is similar to one that I was going to ask, but I like this one a lot, which is, and we'll start with you, Mo, on this one. What do you think is the biggest myth/stereotype that your grantees have about you, grant making in general? So myth and stereotypes about grantors or grant making. What do you think one of the biggest myths is?
Yeah, and it's the one that comes to mind. And I'll say I don't know whether it's the biggest, but certainly one that comes to mind is whether we are actually willing to listen to our grantees and support what they want to do. And I would say, we certainly have tried to be responsive to that, but that's an ongoing conversation. But we make, for example, in our state level systemic change strategy, mostly general operating support grants and multi-year grants as a way to say, we want you to do what you think is important. We're willing to take that back seat. We're willing to come and have conversations with you about what things are going on and what the challenges are. But I think a myth is, that we have to continue to sort of fight against is, are we willing to actually listen to what's going on within an organization and then be responsive to that?
Thank you. Kevin, how about you? What do you think? Myth?
Well, I will say for many years as a development director, I had no idea how to get money out of the Vermont Community Foundation, and it was not for a lack of trying. So, I don't know if it's a myth or a best practice, but it's really important to get to know foundation staff, again, without a particular request in mind. I would say one thing that people tend to think is that our job is to shop their idea around to our fund holders, and we don't do that. It's a very nuanced dance on how we make those connections. I'm on the grants team. We also have a philanthropic advising team, and we work together to make sure that their fund holders are aware of who's doing good work in the community in areas that are meaningful to them. So while we don't take a specific application and shop it around, we want to know. We want to hear from our community partners so that when there's a great idea and we can make a love connection with a philanthropist, that's what we want to do.
I love that. Thank you. And Wendy?
Yes. I think this is a panel that we didn't know each other before we got together, but I think we're swimming with the same strokes. I think largely sharing values and wanting to be common sense in our approach. So I agree with my companions.
Yes. Thank you. And then the next question, we're kind of coming to the top of the hour, but I think this one's a good one. And Kevin, you brought this up a little bit in your comments earlier, which is about communicating and building relationships with funders. I'd love to hear from each of you of a tip or a suggestion, or actually the question I had was, what's one way that an organization communicated with you that really stuck out to you, maybe anecdotally, something that, there's many ways that we can do this, but what tips, or maybe you have a story, organization did this really well, and Kevin, do you have a story or a tip ready for us?
I think it's introducing yourself, casting your net broadly among funders and fund holders, seeing what's out there. I would say my biggest tip is to apply. I get a lot of questions from folks, and they're legitimate questions. Should we apply? And for the most part, I tell them, I can guarantee your chances of getting a grant if you don't apply. It's zero. you know, if you do apply, you're at least getting to hopefully 50-50. So I would say a good way to get to know funders is to start small. Don't apply for the big multi-year grant as your first step out of the gate. Look for something small, because it's a way that you're going to start introducing yourself to hopefully a long-term financial supporter. But it's very nuanced, and you have to make, and relationships just make all the difference.
Thank you. Thanks so much. Go ahead, Wendy. Up, you're on mute.
Phone rang. I've been on a panel years ago when somebody from the gas company said to the grantees, no is not never. Because I know it can be so discouraging. You put in an application and you can't even reach somebody for them to tell you why. I would encourage you to reach out if you get a decline. And importantly, read the websites. Nobody here has emphasized being educated as you approach us. You know, if you're going to approach a funder for something they've never done, your odds aren't as good as if it's right smack in their is what they do zone. Now, that's not to say the brand new thing might not work, but I think you just want to arm yourself. Just like on a job interview, know a lot about the company, know a lot about them. And I do think it is about relationships. I think trust is built through honesty. And so we like our grantees to share with us when they're, call us up when something's going wrong. Don't make us read it in the newspaper. All those kinds of things create authentic relationships.
And I just want to echo, we also encourage a lot of phone calls, you know, call us, talk to us, because we don't want a grantee to waste their time and energy if it's clearly not going to be a good fit. So, and we also try to make sure we leave every call and every query with some sort of value add. And that's something typically we might recommend another funding source. We have a searchable database of funders on our website. But we want to make sure that we leave them with something.
That's really good. I feel like you guys just busted a myth that's out there. Like, can we call? Should we call? What should we do? Oh. Thank you very much. Please call.
Call. Where's the risk? You know, you might not get through, but you might. And also, don't assume that the CEO is the one you have to talk to. Because the truth of the matter is, if you run a good organization, the person who answers the phone is actually helpful. I mean, anybody could be value added to you. So I just think, you know, don't diminish the lower level resources, because they also might give you real insights. And persist, you know, don't be a pest, you know, but persist, because it is relational, and if you can figure out a way to make that relationship, it will enhance your chances, just because you're more real. You have a face that way.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Wendy. How about you, Mel?
I would just echo a lot of what Kevin and Wendy have already said about you know, being in communication with staff at the foundation. One thought that did occur to me, set of applications, if you will, that really stood out for me. We created, as part of our exploratory visionary ideas, something we call the All for NC Fellows, which would be 21 to 35 year olds that have big ideas and just need some resources to support those big ideas. And we decided that in addition to the written application, we would actually have them do videos. And the videos that stood out were those where people were just their authentic selves. I mean, so we had, you know, I can just remember, you know, folk, one driving in a car and talking while driving and in her community. And that just sort of stood out. In a way, you know, others that, you know, really just, you know, you could just tell they were being their authentic self, as opposed to turning the video into a written applique, you know, basically saying the very same thing in the very same way that they would in writing. And so we've tried to, you know, where we can, so, you know, should we find ways to use videos more, because it actually allows people to be their authentic selves, and for us to really see them in ways that maybe a written document would not.
That's great. That's so interesting. Thank you so much for that. It's a great tip. Well, we are already at the top of the hour. I can't believe it. That went really fast. I need to acknowledge that there were over 65 questions in the Q&A and several in the chat. And so sorry that we couldn't get to you all. They were really wonderful. So I just want to thank you for putting those brilliant questions out there. I want to thank our panelists, Wendy, Kevin, Mo, for being with us this afternoon / morning. I also want to thank our partners and sponsors, Foundant, Grand Station, and of course the Grantsmanship Center. We hold the back with the resources and the video. So, and we hope to see you again online.
Thank you.
Glad to have been with everybody.
Thank you, everyone. And persist.
Thank you so much.
Persist.